Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and our panel discussion for this Boxing Day.
Happy Boxing Day.
Kwanzaa.
St. Stephen's Day.
St. Stephen's Day. Day after Christmas. Day. All of those things. Or the ever popular Wednesday.
Happens every week.
Yep. Happens every week indeed. Good morning. Hopefully, we've been off for 2 days. Hopefully you had a lovely time off, maybe, if that's what you did. Or if you didn't, I know, John, you were working. So, mm-hmm. But hopefully, whatever you were able to scrape out, you got to enjoy. Let me just quickly introduce everybody. We were saying before the show, I remember, years and years and years ago, okay, maybe 2 years ago, where the day after Christmas, you were scraping for stories. I mean, just trying to find 5 stories to talk about on the show was impossible. Today, it was not hard. not an issue at all. In fact, we're going to get complaints on all the stuff we left out. So, Terry Gibson is here. He is a former New York State Senator, a SUNY New Paltz communications professor, and our friend. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me here. I look forward to participating.
Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith is with us. Good morning, Jen. How are you?
I'm very well. Top of the morning to you all.
And the rest of the day to yourself. James Ketterer is here, Dean of International Studies at Bard College, Academic Director of the Bard Globalization and International Affairs Program. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me back.
Always a pleasure. And Alan Chartok, good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning to you, Joe, and to the rest of the panel, and to whatever part of our 500,000 monthly listeners are listening to this station. It's wonderful to have you with us.
We love having you here. We think of it as a big get-together where we try to figure out what the hell's happening. So we'll go with... we'll go with the Christmas message that was given by the president yesterday of it's a disgrace what's happening. This was the, of course, shutdown that he pledged to take credit for or own earlier, but now is not. He invited reporters into the Oval Office on Christmas morning to listen to him call military troops overseas. He then unleashed another demand for border wall, a $5 billion price tag that has stalled the federal government through the holidays, and introduced a murky new claim that federal workers are happy to work for free until the wall is fully funded.
Sure.
Many of those workers have said to me, communicated, stay out until you get the funding for the wall, Mr. Trump said. These federal workers want the wall.
Oh, boy. What a lie for a change.
Mr. Trump described immigrants as criminals and human traffickers and espoused plans for his wall, but he declined to answer questions that invited him to be more specific, especially on a contract, he said, was signed Monday to begin construction on a lengthy section of the barrier. Later Tuesday, the White House had no comment about a Border Patrol announcement that an 8-year-old Guatemalan boy had died in custody early on Christmas morning, raising new questions about the administration's zero-tolerance policies on detained migrants. When asked about the living circumstances of the boy who died in custody, a White House spokesman called the death very sad, but officials declined further comment. When reached for comment about the situation, a Department of Homeland Security spokesman pointed to a press release on its website. Mr. Trump in the Oval Office offered no indication of when he thought the partial government shutdown might end, although the representatives for the White House over on the Sunday shows said it could be weeks because the president would not be giving in on anything less than $5 billion.
You know, Joe and panel, one of the things that is so disturbing about this is that I keep thinking what Shakespeare would be writing about this guy. As he has written about mad kings, you know, in the past. Here's this guy, by his own admission, he's, quote, all alone in the White House. We're going to really feel badly about that. They bring Melania back, obviously, because the optics on that one weren't very good. But I read something that really got me, and that was that, you know, this is only partial government shutdown. But the part that really got me is that they have basically de-staffed anybody who handles food stamps or SNAP for the kids. This guy doesn't care. And what's really frightening about him and what really brings Shakespeare to mind here is, what will he do next to distract? And it will be, it could be something that is terribly, terribly dangerous. And now that Mattis is gone, he basically has even more of a finger on the button.
Well, I think it's not that he will do something terribly, terribly dangerous. He is contributing to something terribly, terribly dangerous. And I think, you know, even if you're not upset about these children who are dying and that there are outside agencies who are calling for investigations that aren't happening, there's plenty to get riled up about here. And there's also plenty to fact check about the press conference the other morning. There are so many things that are very misleading and incorrect, especially about the contract itself, what that actually goes for. For those of the people who think like, oh, it's just building a new wall, that's not true. It's repairing existing wall. There are lots to look at in terms of who the contractor is. It's kind of curious that the same contractor has been getting these bids over and over again, hundreds of millions of dollars. There's just a lot to unpack with this current issue.
No, Jen, not to disagree with you, because who could disagree with you? But, what he's doing has terrible repercussions, and I think I've mentioned that. But what I'm really concerned about is the possibility of his doing something so bad that it could put the world in jeopardy. I mean, really in jeopardy, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like every time I come onto this program, one of the things I say is that we've been lucky so far, in a way, as much as things are happening that are deeply troubling, we've been lucky that there hasn't been a major international crisis, or there hasn't been a major attack on the United States. There hasn't been something that has required that all the pieces of the national security establishment come together quickly and operate in the way that they're normally trained to do, and at the highest levels, where you have the people at the cabinet level who are sorting through, you know, minute by minute, how to respond to something that is truly frightening in some cases, and in some cases could be, really at the precipice of war. And so with, you know, the president tweeting out things like, I'm all alone in the White House, with him removing people who have otherwise been seen, like Secretary Mattis, as playing those kind of crucial roles, you know, I see that a lot of people that I'm in touch with and that I know who have been in those positions in the national security establishment, saying that they're really quite worried about not if it happens, but when it happens, when there is a crisis, how will those pieces of the government respond if they're just really not operating properly?
Isn't it possible that we're already in a crisis, though, and we just somehow aren't able to recognize it? If we look at the financial situation across the globe right now, as of today, we know that that outlook does not look good either in this country or other countries. If we look at all of the various things that have happened over the last year or two in terms of how foreign countries have hacked into our internet systems and have stolen so much data and put so many people's lives and businesses in jeopardy. If we look at the chaos that exists within our presidential administration, where it's clear that there is no real ability to lead or to govern, maybe we already are in a crisis and we just don't realize that we're in a downward spiral.
I think there's just a lot of pockets of infrastructure that, has been jeopardized and undermined. All the things that you just named, looking at, you know, the depths of which gerrymandering has happened to corrupt our political process in terms of voting systems and things like that, general infrastructure, healthcare. These are things that are building social economic gaps that if a crisis, that your friends are worried about, Jim, are to happen, it's going to be that much more devastating because there's not a solid foundation underneath so much of what drives people's daily lives.
Yeah, and I'm not taking away from any of that that either of you have said, but I'm also responding to Alan's comment, you know, using the phrase "the finger on the button," and so I'm talking about also the sorts of things that existentially, you know, could happen in the matter of minutes, the things that could imperil the lives of many, many, many people. I'm astounded the level to which most Americans don't realize, for instance, I mean, to be direct about what Alan was saying, that nuclear weapons are fully in the control of one person. That is, it's an old and outdated system, but that's the system. Mm. One person, and I think most Americans think, oh, there's all sorts of, you know, things built into the system and there's fail safes and, you know, one person. That is not how it works. That's just absolutely not how it works. Most Americans also think that we could easily shoot down incoming nuclear-tipped missiles. That is not true. It's simply not true. So I don't mean to ruin everybody's Boxing Day or St. Stephen's Day, but Alan is right that this is something that should have been addressed a long time ago, not just during this administration. So I definitely stipulate to the fact that there's lots of infrastructural problems. There's definitely issues I think we're going to talk about with the financial industry. But there's also kind of immediate national security issues that could just pop up and that we'll all later say, oh, we were completely taken by surprise. But I think we shouldn't be surprised.
Well, with no adult in the room. That's the problem. With Mattis gone. What, and this, I mean, certainly Jen is right. There are many, many things that are wrong. I mentioned, for example, the idea about the SNAP benefits or the fact that kids weren't going to be able to eat lunch and the rest of it. That's all terribly important. We know that. But you are so right, Jim. If in fact, you know, one day on impulse, this guy who really has some major problems, I think psychological problems, decides that the ultimate distraction is a nuclear weapon.
Well, that's the problem too with Mattis leaving, and you've got Trump kind of in his position, and then you wonder, you know, what can Bolton Pompeo do in this situation? Should something, like you say, happen overnight, which could literally quite be imminent?
Well, I worry too that the optics of how chaotic our system seems to be right now, how leaderless we seem to be right now, that they resonate with other countries that maybe want to find ways to attack us. If you are someone that wants to take something from the United States right now, you have to be very cognizant of the fact that we are in a very weak state right now. We are not in an ability right now to quickly to be able to defend ourselves. We don't, as you mentioned before, stand on any type of stable foundation, whether it be infrastructure, whether it be education, whether it be economic. At all levels, we are very weak right now and very vulnerable.
Yeah, imagine a targeted cyber attack on the financial industry at this moment.
And it all stems directly back to, it all goes directly back to the White House, where that is the place where at all times you want to be able to say we have leadership. Maybe we don't have leadership that we agree with on a daily basis. Maybe we have leadership that's very controversial. But at the end of the day, we still believe we have someone that is capable of leading the country. And we just don't have that right now. And it's very scary.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I think it's important for us to remember, lest we get too freaked out,
save
that
us.
There are amazing people working in the federal government, in the military, in the intelligence community, in the diplomatic community, many of these people are still working, who are considered, you know, essential employees, and that they are working around the clock. So it's not that no one is at home. It's not that no one's paying attention. But I do think it calls into question for all of us, what's the role of leadership?
But they don't have the right to say no. Isn't that right?
That's right. I mean,
that's
look at
correct.
Mattis is the, well, let's use Mattis as the example of, here's the guy who's saying to him, don't take troops out of Syria. Don't do that in Afghanistan. And does just the opposite.
Yeah.
And not the only voice in that room. So even if you have those people, which is somewhat comforting, but if you're not listening to them and you're just going to do whatever, and there is no plan beyond that, well, that is deeply troubling, isn't it?
I'd recommend that everybody read, if they haven't already, the message that Mattis sent out to the troops around the world yesterday. And in it, he uses the phrase something like, storm clouds are gathering. And that's pretty ominous coming from our Secretary of Defense.
Well, that's what happens, too, when you as a leader are undermining your experts and their expertise in what they know. And you should, if you're a good leader, you're trusting these people to give you good intelligence, to inform the decisions that you make. And I think left and right and constantly in this world, we're seeing people who are good, who are smart, who know what they're talking about, who know how to address these situations or can figure out great strategies how, are constantly just being pushed aside for ego.
Well, and it's not that they're just being pushed aside, because it's not out of the ordinary for a president to disagree with his advisors or to do something different than his advisors want them to do. But what is different is that they're being pushed aside and ignored without any real effort to build a case mm-hmm. to the American public that I have made a conscious decision to take this action based on this evidence, based mm-hmm. on this reasoning, based on this logic, based on this long-term plan. That's what's missing. Mm-hmm. And that's what's terrifying about it.
Yeah, but think for a second about the Kennedy missile crisis and Cuba. It was extraordinary. You knew how hard that guy was working. He had Bobby. He had everybody in the State Department. He had all of these generals and everybody else, and they were working full time, and it was all integrated. You don't get that sense here now.
I think we'll talk more about this later in the show, but from the Cuban Missile Crisis case is also the time in which John and Robert Kennedy were pushing back against some of their advisors. They were marshaling their own facts and making a case because behind the scenes, you have to hash these things out and not everybody agrees.
Sure, there was always Curtis LeMay, you may remember.
Yes.
Always wanted to bomb the hell out of everybody.
Yeah. If you read about the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that's a great, great comparison. You see that it was a group of people, a group of human beings that all had their own individual opinions. They were voicing them very clearly. There was a lot of opposition to the ideas that the Kennedys had, but they worked it out, and they worked it out in a methodical, logical, responsible way that ended up being the right choice that saved our country. And we just seem to have no sense of how to do that anymore.
We have to take a break in just about 30 seconds, and we'll go to letters, and we'll talk more about this. But the other sobering thing is that there doesn't seem to be there's no guarantee if you had what was considered Thomas Friedman made this case over the weekend in the Times that if you have your A team and now they're gone and now you have the B team, which is people that you're basically begging to take the job. Then what happens?
And incompetent nincompoops. Let's take a look at what Mattis is being replaced with, a guy who is, sort of in charge of procurement.
I'm not sure it's the B team. I think we're kind of down to the C team now.
Mm. I was just going in order, but you're probably right. You're probably right. I was trying to, yeah. There is a lot to talk about, and we'll continue doing that. We have a wonderful panel. We welcome you to join us. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Terry Gibson is here. Jen Smith, Jim Ketterher, and Alan Chartok. We do welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 35 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Wednesday morning, the 26th of December. We have been talking about the shutdown and a lot of other stuff on the periphery of that. We have a fistful of letters, so we'll start there and move on.
And, of course, we invite more. You got something
Absolutely.
To say.
Absolutely. Panel@WAMC.org.
Okay, so Joel says, good morning. Mattis will be Secretary of Defense for another few days. He should stage a coup, remove Trump and Pence from office, and call for a new election in the spring. What do you think, gang? Well,
Mighty Mattis to the rescue?
I've lived in countries that have had coups, and I don't recommend it.
Yeah. It's a very bad precedent and president.
Well, third world countries that are struggling at all different levels often resort to that type of system, and I hope that we're not there. Mm.
But what? Just what? First of all, I agree with what you've all said. But of course, what if this guy really goes so far off the rails? Now, you have a 25th Amendment, then you have the ability to take him out by the principal members of his government, meaning the cabinet. Unlikely they're ever going to do that. That 40% is still staying there. I doubt anything would ever make that doable, unless, of course, Mitch McConnell thought his own particular job was in jeopardy.
Well, there's a military coup and there's a political coup. I guess I would prefer a political variety. I certainly would be leery of the military taking over our government.
So would you think the 25th Amendment would be not a military coup? It would be a political coup?
I would think so. I would think it would take Congress in the Senate and the House to put that in motion and see it through. So we'd definitely have to have political power behind it.
What do you think, Jim?
Yeah. I mean, I think it would not meet our standard definition of coup if you're following the Constitution.
True.
So sure. I mean, I think, it is worth remembering the people who voiced all kinds of concern when Trump came into office and started appointing lots of recently retired or currently serving military brass. That is certainly something that has always raised concerns that, you know, the Constitution says that the government should be under civilian control. And I think if we lose sight of that, or if people start to think that that's the next best alternative, that sends us down a very frightening road.
Okay, so let's take it to the most ridiculous extent, because that's the way you always have to judge these things. Let's just say that Trump did what he said he could do, which is to kill somebody on Fifth Avenue in front of everybody. And not be held responsible, and the people would not hold him responsible. Would the 25th Amendment be the way to go?
Well, I think it has to be seriously considered at that point. I think on January 1st, when we have the Democrats taking over control of the House, I think we're in a position to where those types of things can be looked at in a way that they couldn't before, because the Republican-controlled Congress just refused to do their job. I still think it's going to be a heavy lift. But if you're talking about him physically committing murder,
yes,
in broad daylight,
there'd be riots.
I do think that there are a wide variety of options in terms of just pure simple law enforcement that would be engaged, and I do think that would be the end.
How come?
Of
Wait a second now. I don't get that. Not to give you.
Well, let's say on a security camera, you see the President of the United States actually shooting someone on Fifth Avenue, and there's documented evidence of that. I think it's going to be difficult for law enforcement in general to take action and remove him from office.
It would be chaos. I mean, if in all seriousness, if that happened, I mean, you've seen what's happened this year, with Charlottesville and in places like Ferguson. If something like that were to happen, that would unravel, I think, so much of the tension that has been building across our country of what's going on. And I think you'd have, I don't know how you would respond to something on
and
that
yet,
scale.
But, and yet you have a Justice Department whose Office of Legal Counsel has a memo out there that says no indicting a city predator.
Right. I had this feeling that you were trying to take us down this path.
Well,
that, to think metaphorically, can a sitting president be indicted?
Yeah.
And what would it take? What would be the threshold for that? Still an open question.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Matthew says, shutdown. While many federal workers will get back pay, many will not. I'm a field representative for the Census Bureau, and we are paid hourly for the time we actually work. While this job is not my primary source of income, most of my coworkers depend on these paychecks. They will receive, in capital letters, nothing for the shutdown period. There are real human consequences from what's presented as a political squabble, but not for the President of the United States who's getting his meals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
me.
If that letter, that's an interesting letter to hear that. The census is very important. We want to make sure the data is collected is accurate. You need the morale of the individuals out doing this to be excited about what they're doing and feel as if they're recognized. And when you're not paying people, that's not a good way to incentivize them. I know I heard today just on NPR this morning that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, is laying off like 10,000 people, and they're putting out statements right now making sure that everyone knows that everything will still be protected and investigated, and we don't have to worry about toxins in our food, but do you really believe that? I mean, it feels like we should be worried when 10,000 people are being laid off.
And yet, there is always a political consequences or implication for everything. So, for example, this panel will be able to tell you that the census is a matter of real politics right now. There are people who do not want us to get it right,
right,
for a lot of reasons.
Right.
And so, you know, there may be somebody sitting up there saying, well, so the census doesn't get taken properly. And that will mean that there's an undercount in particular places where we really would want there to be an undercount. Yeah. Okay, so is that enough on that one?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Let's go to the next one.
Hello again, says Modesto. Weapons of mass destruction. I cannot speak for the entire delivery of for weapons of mass destruction, but I know for sure in the Navy there are most definitively fail-safes and two-person concept before a weapon can be launched. Especially on submarines, they're also very smart sailors. Servicemen, this is a good one, all right, and women who obey commands but are not robots. They're very intelligent Americans on watch, standing duty right now. I served on submarines for 13 years. One button does not control it all. Happy New Year and peace, says Modesto. Jim?
So that is certainly true on a submarine. And it is... It's an interesting case to imagine that somewhere in the chain of command you would have uniformed military personnel who would say that this order to launch is an illegal order and we're not going to follow it. But if they all do what they are ordered to do, there is no one in that chain of command who can countermand the president's decision to fire. And so, short of somebody saying we're just not going to follow this, or something else kind of extraordinary happening from the top, there's no second person.
There's a whole movie about this scenario called Red Tide, I believe. That's the name of it. It's a submarine movie. Denzel Washington is in it. They're put in this exact same scenario. The reason I bring this up is because all too often I believe that what's happening now in our country is that we are, instead of legislating and governing, we're now operating as a Hollywood TV reality show with Donald Trump being the lead character.
Right.
And
so Crimson Tide, I think it is.
What's it called? Crimson Tide. That's not Red Tide. Crimson Tide. Thank you. That's exactly
Red Tide's
right.
A whole other issue that we're dealing with, too.
Right. I'm sorry. Yeah. I knew I was in the ballpark there. Thank you for that correction. But that script you just talked about there actually exists in that movie.
And speaking of movies, if you haven't seen it lately, 7 Days in May, which I believe Kirk Douglas and who's the other guy, Joe? Kirk Douglas, 7 Days in May. In any case, you know, there's a point at which you have to stand up and say something's going on here that isn't right. But that wasn't this particular scenario that you're...
Yeah. Speaking of movies having...
Burt Lancaster.
An effect on public policy, probably the one about nuclear weapons that had the biggest effect was The Day After.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And during the Reagan administration.
Yeah. And Bob says, Mexico! Explanation point. Why don't those opposed to spending $5 billion on a wall simply say that the campaign promise wasn't just to build a wall, but to build a wall and have Mexico pay for it? It shouldn't be for the U.S. Congress to allocate funds for it. Now, Bob, to be fair, it isn't as if the whole country has been mute on that point. They have been saying so over and over and over again. But the president doesn't seem to remember that he said it.
What's he calling it now, a slatted... barrier?
Steel slat wall.
Well, and he's referring to the architecture of these balusters.
Well, he tweeted a picture.
The Washington Post did this great story a few days ago on the steel slat design.
Exactly.
You saw that? And they did a great design comparison analysis. They figured out what it would cost. They showed that $5 million will come nowhere near covering the cost of it.
$5 billion.
They also $5 billion. They also put the specs out there to show how unstable it would be. That if you build something that tall without any horizontal support, that it could never stand up. But the greatest thing about that article, if you haven't seen it, I really think you should look it up. They found a Chinese restaurant in China that at the entrance to the restaurant, they had this gimmick where if you can fit through a steel slat fence of a certain width, which happens to be about the same width as his proposal, you get a free meal. And they have various... What? Yeah, no, they have various different versions of this fence. So there's a prototype of his fence right now.
In a Chinese restaurant.
And people are sliding through it to get free meals. Also, the fact that you can just pass a bag of drugs right through the fence and pretty much anything else you want also has to be acknowledged.
Well, one of my very smart family members was pointing out, as we were discussing this yesterday, Christmas Day, that the president keeps on saying this has to be a steel slat wall. Think about how much he's talked about reviving the steel industry, mm-hmm. steel tariffs, and I don't know how much of that is intentional or not, but it's worth noting.
Absolutely.
Interesting. And Reed says, wall funding. Why don't Chuck and Nancy just tell POTUS that when Mexico sends the check for the wall, they'll consider its construction? Wasn't Mexican funding one of the most of the major complaints of Trump's campaign proposal for the wall? Yeah, we've talked about that. And Bob says, the button. It would take between 6 and 15 minutes for a flight of ICBMs from Russia or North Korea to reach the U.S. mainland. While I'm as horrified as anybody by the idea of Trump being the one to decide about responding, it's hard to see a viable alternative to the president being the one to make that decision. What alternative is the panel proposing? And that's Bob from Albany. Well, Bob, there's something in your letter, in your note, that makes me think about this a little bit. He says about Trump being the one to decide about responding. I'm not sure we're talking about responding here. I think we're talking about starting it, about sending one the other way.
I suppose that's possible. You know, I think another thing that most Americans, many Americans, don't realize is that the U.S. has never given up the first strike capacity. That, you know, we still have, very much have that. And I think many people think we could only respond to something. But on the other part of that letter, though, I mean, there are people who know these systems very well who I think have fully elaborated proposals on an alternative to having one person decide this. But obviously, in 6 to 15 minutes, it's going to be difficult.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more items to discuss. We will do so in just a moment. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us go to some other subjects and talk about other things. Alan has mentioned this, but I think it's important that we go back to the Dow and the markets and what happened specifically on Monday, where there was a 600-point drop in the market, and it was stunning. It was the worst Christmas Eve ever, and I believe in the history of the market. And
I think worse than 29.
And then from my understanding is that at the end of the month we are poised to have the worst December since the Great Depression. So that is in and of itself something to talk about. But let us not forget the other issue, which was the markets are tanking. So here's the general wisdom on this is that the president's big plus, if you will, is the state of the market and state of the economy. So now with that starting to drift, then comes the blame game. So who do you blame? Well, you try apparently on Saturday to get rid of the head of the Fed. And was asking around of how you do that and was pretty much told, you can't really do that. Then the plan was hatched for Steve Mnuchin to call up the bankers, the big bankers, and to work on a big plunge committee. What was it called?
The plunge protection committee.
And
that didn't work.
And to calm their fears, and yes, it didn't work. And then the market just went into complete chaos on Monday, and then on Tuesday, the president apparently now has it out for Mnuchin, who he is blaming on this.
Well, since then, Joe, he's come back and said he has faith in Mnuchin. He had to, because everybody's talking about the possibility he's going to fire him. Mm-hmm.
Well, so, and now what do we make of all of this? I don't, it's a lot, isn't it?
Well, it's just goes to, again, to show how ill-equipped and inexperienced and unqualified this person is to be president of the United States. I mean, he's literally putting the country in a state of panic over something that the country wasn't even sure it should be panicked about. By bringing this to people's attention in such a way that is so irresponsible. I think somebody in one of those articles you just mentioned talked about this being equivalent to talking about the fact that we need to be prepared to be hit by asteroids when no one really knew that there was an asteroid coming to hit us. So it's incompetent.
I just think, again, there's just a series of missteps and decision-making by people who don't know how to handle this situation. I mean, you know, for Mnuchin, for one, to call something like, if ever you're going to spook a spook a marketplace, that's the way to do it, is to call an emergency meeting with your top six bank leaders. Not a good idea. You know, I think, and it's in combination with, you know, you've got the Fed continuing with their gradual rate hikes, and you have the effects, the outcomes of the tax stimulus. So that's going to start, you know, we have this great stimulus.
Say nothing about
season.
The debt.
Yeah.
Right.
I think, again, but no one prepared for, you know, all these elements were in works, but no one prepared for the outcomes. And I think that's what we're stuck with dealing with now. And I think adding the optics that we have, you know, whether it's the talk about the markets, whether it's, you know, the trade tariffs that are being put on China and all this uncertainty, is going to perpetuate the state of, you know, uncertainty.
Don't you think that George W. Bush and Barack Obama got tremendous credit for the 08 basically bailout and what they did there? Now, my history isn't as good as it should be, but I think I remember that they reached out to Republicans and Democrats and they called some of these people. I think this may have been an attempt on the president and Mnuchin's part to borrow from that playbook. It just didn't work.
Well, because it didn't work because what the situations you described were much more complex than just the president picking up the phone to one person and saying, do this. It was cases where presidents reached out to hundreds of advisors and hundreds of experts and gathered people around for weeks and months on end to figure out a plan to move forward. So there's no comparison, really, to what this president is doing to any other really recent president in any form of crisis whatsoever.
You also have a unique situation where you have a decent economy, right? There's, you know, right now there's still some consumer trust, you know, holiday spending was up, for example, but then you have the marketplace, which is in turmoil. So there, you've got these two different, you know, counter effects happening all at once.
Yeah. What's the relationship between Wall Street and Main Street?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the relationship between specific policy decisions and what's going on in the market? Now, you know, the market has been going up steadily since 2009, unlikely probably to go up forever.
Right.
And, you know, how can the Fed manage that? Well, clearly being hectored by the president specifically is probably not a helpful way to manage what was going to be an inevitable flat line, if not downward trend for a while. But then, Jen, as you mentioned, you know, the trade wars that are manifested in tariffs. And I think it's important for people to remember that tariffs are taxes. Farmers having to be bailed out in the midst of these trade wars. Mm-hmm. And as Alan mentioned, you know, the federal deficit, which is absolutely ballooning now, that the tax stimulus has not stimulated enough to make up for that deficit, which I think is predicted to be in the next year, in 2019, over $900 billion.
And somebody's got to pay the vigorish on that debt, which means that we're spending as much money doing that as providing services of any kind here in this country. I think I'm right about that.
Well, and this president is not one that has any type of record of paying debts. I mean, this is not a person that understands what it's like to be in debt or to pay debts or to take any type of financial responsibility for anything. And he's also finding out that what he has relied on his entire career is his ability to talk his way into and out of whatever situations he wanted to deal with. He's now realizing that he's in a situation for the first time in his life where no matter how hard he talks, no matter what he says, his ability to manipulate the stock market is extremely limited. Certainly trying to make it better is extremely limited by just simple words.
And what happened to the deficit and tax hawks in the Republican Party? As I said, tariffs are taxes, and the deficit is ballooning, and we simply don't hear much from the party that has made that a pillar of their platform.
Right. There's no plan to say, like, okay, well, we have potential GDP growth. Like, how do we use that to attack our deficit problem? And you don't have a Fed and a Treasury that are communicating with one another.
And as you guys have mentioned, on top of all of this comes an out-of-control president who is now talking about firing the guy he put in charge of the Fed. How does that make somebody sitting on the street who thinks volatility is a bad thing?
Yes, not good at all.
We should mention, as of this moment, the Dow is up 114 points, so we will...
It's because of this radio show.
Say we can take
us. We're doing it. That's us, yes.
Well, some people are doing what one does. You buy low and
you hope for the best.
But 100 and something is not 600 on one day.
It is not.
And 500 on another day.
And we have a lot of hours to go.
There's only five
today.
Of us here. So do some
work. Let's take a break. We're going to go to news with Ray Graff, and we'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome to our panel for today, the 26th of December. Very nice to have you all with us. Terry Gibson is here, Jen Smith, Jim Ketterher, Alan Chartok, and he has letters. We'll go to those, and then we'll move on to some other topics.
I do. When talking political coup, says Phil, remember Thatcher and almost Germany's Merkel. It can work if done correctly. Jim?
If we change the United States into a parliamentary system, sure. But that's not the system we have. I mean, one of the things that people have always been worried about with presidential systems, the kind of system that we have, is the potential for serious deadlock and political crisis that follows the deadlock. And most countries that have had presidential systems outside of the United States have fallen prey to crises that are brought on by these deadlocks.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I do think it would just be interesting to see, even though we don't have that kind of system, is how the prime minister comes before parliament and speaks, and everyone sits there and speaks up and yells and screams and says,
"I love
what,
questions."
It would be interesting just to see Donald Trump have to deal with that type of situation.
Oh yeah, right. Sure.
He can't even handle the press correspondents dinner. Right. So,
Paul says, "Coup? Are you really giving airtime to discussing a coup? You've gone off the rails. Maybe you should take a break from discussing Trump. This is too much." Hey, Paul, we didn't. Somebody wrote a letter. We responded to the letter. What are you talking about? Give us a break. Okay, and Ed says, big concerns. I've studied American history and foreign policy for many years, and Alan, Jim, and Terry are absolutely correct regarding these concerns about what's taking place in the White House and the Cuban Missile Crisis precedent. The absence of a steadying hand next to Trump should be of major concern to every Democrat and indeed to humanity. No doubt this is what Secretary Jim Mattis had alluded to in his recent communications. The 25th Amendment is indeed relevant today. If there's any hope of extricating ourselves from this crisis, it looks like a great deal hinges on the U.S. Senate, controlled, for better or worse, by the GOP. Perhaps the public should be provided with Mitch McConnell's 1-800 number. And that is from Ed. And Scott says, I agree with letter writer Bob, not Alan. I listen to the news all the time. Every single Democrat should be repeating the Mexico should play for the wall thing. I'm hearing very capital letters. Very few politicians say this. This should be the only capital letters response from a Democratic politician when asked about the wall. Instead, I hear Schumer and others discussing amounts like $1 billion or $2 billion. That shouldn't even come up. I'm annoyed daily that the Democratic politicians aren't driving this point home.
I was going to say, shouldn't we also be talking at some level about what it is that a wall is meant to address? Isn't it the case?
Is a physical wall the most effective tool for protecting and you know organizing our borders? And I think both sides, both geographies, both governments have a stake in activity at the borders.
Yes, but I have to say, I thought Jim was going to mention this, that it isn't as if there is silence about Mexico paying and the hypocrisy of his saying it.
Not at all.
I've heard it again and again and again.
Well, in the press reports, but he does make a point of, you have Senator Schumer walking into the Oval Office and saying, hey, here's what we're going to put in. Well, why are you bringing that up, and shouldn't you instead be saying we don't need it?
Mm. Well, I also think that the Democratic political leaders and some Republicans, too, are also cognizant of the fact that the more that they talk about his wall, the more credit they give to it and the more airtime it gets. And that I think good, responsible public servants realize that if we want to talk about building things and who's going to pay for it, we need to start talking about real infrastructure needs inside of our borders. Our roads, our bridges, our water systems are crumbling and deteriorating. We have tunnels here and even in New York that need desperate help from the federal government. So to put more and more focus on this wall just distracts, which I think might ultimately be the purpose of what really needs to be done in this country, and the president doesn't seem to be interested in doing that.
But I'd be interested, Terry, in getting your opinion, because you've been an elected member. It seems to me that the Senator Schumer is making a decision, a tactical decision, by saying, well, we're going to offer something, because if we don't appear to be offering something, it's going to look bad for the Democrats. We're going to just seen as obstructionists. So we can't just say, well, let the Mexicans pay for it, because then we're blamed for closing down the government.
Yeah, but there are subtleties to it. They are saying, if you listen real carefully to what they're saying, and say, we'll give you the $1.5 billion, but not for the construction of the wall, for security, which is very different, don't you think?
Yes. Absolutely. What I'm hearing is that they're willing to compromise in the name of security, because there is a level of security that all sides agree on. That, certainly we don't want to have open borders. We do need to have security. We do need to improve the security that we have there. But there are ways to do that may be more effective and are proven to be more effective than building a literal wall.
So Stephen says, deficit hawks. GOP are deficit hawks only during Democratic administrations. Steve, I think that makes a point. And Peter says, enough is enough. Dear panel, you're all correct about the president. He's corrupt, ignorant, and a liar. It's past time for him to go. I wonder if we need Robert Mueller's findings to get rid of us of this evil man. In the past 2 years, the press has uncovered many high crimes and misdemeanors within Trump world, which the roundtable has covered thoroughly and well. If there were enough decent and honorable members of the GOP in the cabinet, then they could invoke the 25th Amendment and remove Donald J. Trump as a person unfit to be president. One can only hope. Happy New Year to the panel. That's from Peter.
Happy New Year, Peter.
That's quite a Happy New Year.
Yeah. And Ellen says, Alan, I am right with you and agree with the alarm you are expressing. In fact, Shakespeare is exactly what I've been thinking about. My question is, please tell me what you think. Is there anyone in the chain of command who can refuse to follow the order to, say, do a first strike against the country? Fire nuclear weapons, as mentioned last week, at North Korea. Could the Joint Chiefs refuse? Thanks. So grateful for the honest discussion of the dangers chasing us. Jim.
Yeah, I think we've covered that. People could stand up and say this is an illegal order, or this is just ridiculous, or clearly these people are not robots. So we could imagine a scenario in which that happens. But do we want to place our trust in the outside chance that something like that would happen?
And then somebody would have the guts to say, I'll break the law in order to protect the country.
Exactly.
The world. Okay, and then we heard from Mandy in Wales. Murdering someone on Fifth Avenue in New York violates a state law. The Department of Justice's policy about indicting a president would not apply to state law enforcement. I've been thinking about this letter ever since we got it. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting because here, we have something in this country called dual federalism, meaning that you have sovereignty, allegedly, between the states and the feds. but not absolutely really, because as the Supreme Court has made one decision after another, it would appear that the feds have the upper hand. Can you imagine the New York City cops coming along, putting the cuffs on Donald J. Trump on Fifth Avenue? This is all absurd, of course, and saying, all right, you're under arrest, and what the feds would do then?
I can't imagine. I don't think Donald Trump's ever going to come back to New York as the sitting president, to start with. I'd be on the front row to watch it if it did happen, I can tell you that.
Mary says, our child president, our spoiled brat president, is holding real low-income and migrant children hostage while he throws a tantrum over his border wall. The deaths of two child hostages in our custody, and as Alan points out, the hunger of U.S. kids deprived of food stamps, makes it clear that it is time to treat Trump like the child he is and take away what he thinks of as his toys. And that's from Mary, and Leslie says...
But is the president properly reading his base and saying, this resonates well with the base, this helps me politically, all the downsides being what they are, that the base wants this wall, they want me to stand up to the Democrats, and it works.
And the answer is yes. Right. The answer is to that is yes. And we see it because we see the polls. And we know that 40% ain't moving, even if it's their child who isn't going to get a food stamp. And Leslie says, watch Vice review of 2008 meltdown. HBO Vice News is a recap of 2008 financial crisis. Back then, there were competent people at the helm. Even with the most competent stewards, we almost fell into the abyss. The crew that is in place now is nowhere near as competent. If there is a crisis, we are doomed. Mm. Those are the letters I got, Joe.
All right. Let's go to some other topics as we try to get as much in before we leave here in just a few minutes. Let's talk about Syria, especially while we have Jim here. President's decision to withdraw all American troops from Syria within 30 days risks leaving United States allies in the long-running war weakened while strengthening rivals backed by Iran and Russia. American troops entered Syria in 2015 as part of a coalition fighting the Islamic State, which had seized large swaths of territory in Syria and Iraq. This is from the New York Times. Also, we add to that the president's announcement of the desire to withdraw troops from Afghanistan as well. And those are, I mean, this, of course, is what started the whole Mattis affair, if you will, and the president not listening to his advisors. There is a reason those advisors were saying the things that they were saying, correct?
That's true. But I consistently argue that the nation needs to have a serious conversation about what it is we're doing with the troops we have deployed in combat areas, in particular Afghanistan, where we've had troops for 17 years, in Iraq, where we still have over 5,000 troops, and in Syria, where we have this case that we're talking about now. And so we've lurched from just not paying any attention to it whatsoever, and it's just kind of on autopilot, and really deferring to the Pentagon on many of these decisions, following the best advice of our generals is usually the phrase, to now the president just, with apparently not at all following what's known as the interagency process in the United States government. It's something that drives everybody crazy when you're working in the government, but it's crucial. Just deciding that we're going to cut the number of troops in Afghanistan in half and we're going to take them out of Syria. Both of these extremes, I think, are clearly the wrong way to go, to be on autopilot and not pay attention, or to just decide without consulting with allies, without consulting with the relevant agencies in the U.S. government, to just do it, just do something. But I think it's so the process, it's so boring in many ways to talk about process, but it's so important to figure out how these decisions are made and what the implications are of not following a proper process. I think that when the Democrats take control of the House, that the House Foreign Affairs Committee, the House Armed Services Committee, that they should hold hearings where these issues are aired at length, where the relevant people are called on the Hill, and that they are required to answer questions about what are our policies in these places? What are we doing with these troops? How long will they be there? What are the missions that they are set to accomplish, and what are the resources they need to actually accomplish those missions? Absent of that, these decisions are just lurching from one thing to another. I mean, we can talk about like the details on the ground and why this is a bad decision for Trump to make. But at the same time, a couple of months ago, I was here on this panel when the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, had said that we were going to have troops in Syria indefinitely. Well, that should get people's attention, that we're going to have troops anywhere indefinitely.
Including Afghanistan.
And it got no attention whatsoever. And so for the Pentagon to say, well, we'll have troops there for as long as it takes to change the nature of the Syrian regime and to make sure that we get rid of the Iranian influence in Syria. Well, both of those things are unlikely to happen anytime soon. So what that basically means is the Pentagon is saying to the White House, well, if we don't meet these conditions, these troops will be there forever.
But I certainly understand that. But the problem with the president's decision, of course, is that, as you pointed out, it's disregarding the process at all. Even if that were the recommendation to keep troops as long as possible, and as you argue, we should be discussing of how you change this without troop presence, I understand that. But just this willy-nilly nature is really what
piques, you know, raises my eyebrow and says, you know, why now? Why are we calling for this now? And then why are you backpedaling on this now and saying, you know, like going, you know, from all gone as soon as possible to, well, now we're going to linger on, like, what is the timing of this due? And you know, what relationships is this affecting, this decision making, you know, with our allies?
With Erdogan.
That's what we hear. It's the call.
Yeah, but, with Erdogan, who is a NATO. Turkey is a NATO ally. We also see that the French may be moving in to fill the vacuum, another NATO ally, on the side of the Kurds to fend off the Turks. So we may have NATO allies facing each other off over other allies, the Kurds that we've abandoned, in the midst of an utterly chaotic situation in Syria that's been created over the course of two administrations. Also, the Obama administration does not have a lot to be proud of in terms of American policy in Syria.
Even thinking about it, whether we should have been there in the first place, right? And also Afghanistan. I mean, there was a piece, I think, on NPR this morning in which, you know, the Russians were in Afghanistan for how long? 17 years or something like that, some incredible amount of time, and they couldn't get themselves out of it.
Well, it should also be alarming to American citizens that Russia seems to be excited about the fact that we're leaving, and Iran seems to be excited about the fact that we're leaving, and Israel seems to be very concerned about the fact that we're leaving. So just those three countries alone and their reactions, I think, is enough to send a lot of alarm bells off.
It goes back to that timing. I mean, just as this was happening, Trump also lifted sanctions on a Russian aluminum oligarch. And, you know, why now? again, these are the questions that I really wonder of, you know, how does this all play into the bigger picture of, again, not just greater relationships between allies, but also these other interpersonally related relationships between people of power and global powers, and what sort of power plays does this create?
To say nothing about the coming Mueller report. Mm. I mean, it all comes together here.
Mm. And I think we're, you know, the president, but people in general are much too quick to declare the victory over the Islamic State. And we can see, you know, there's been some very interesting reporting coming from Iraq on Ben Taub just wrote a great piece in The New Yorker that I highly recommend people to read about the way that the Iraqi government is behaving and playing right into the hands of the rejuvenation of the Islamic State.
We are out of time. But my thanks to everyone for tuning in this morning. Terry Gibson, Jen Smith, Jim Ketterer, and Alan Chartok. Thank you all. We'll be back tomorrow with more. We'll continue our program right after this short break.